Until Rita lifted up her hand in front of her. Her left hand. Now with a large diamond ring sparkling on her ring finger. Chutsky's ring.
Oh, Dexter,
she said again, and then buried her face in my shoulder.
Yes, yes, yes! Oh, you've made me so happy.
All right, Cody said softly. And after that, what can you say except congratulations? The rest of the evening passed in a blur of disbelief and Miller Lite. I knew very well that hovering somewhere out in space was a perfect, calm, logical series of words that I could put together and say to Rita to make her understand that I had not actually proposed to her, and we would all have a good laugh and say goodnight. But the harder I searched for that magical, elusive sentence, the faster it ran away from me. And I found myself reasoning that perhaps one more beer would unlock the doors of perception. And after several cans, Rita went up to the corner store and returned with a bottle of champagne. We drank the champagne, and everyone seemed so very happy. And one thing led to another, and somehow I ended up in Rita's bed once again. Witness to some exceedingly unlikely and undignified events. And once again, I found myself wondering, as I drifted off to stunned and unbelieving sleep, how do these terrible things always happen to me? Waking up after a night like that is never very pleasant. Waking up in the middle of the night and thinking, "Oh God, Deborah," is even worse. You may think I was guilty or uneasy about neglecting someone who depended on me, in which case you would be very wrong. As I have said, I don't really feel emotions. I can, however, experience fear, and the idea of Deborah's potential rage pulled the trigger. I hurried into my clothes and managed to slip out to my car without waking anyone. Sergeant Doakes was no longer in his position across the street. It was nice to know that even Doakes needed to sleep sometime. Or perhaps he had thought that someone who had just got engaged deserved a little privacy. Knowing him as I did, however, this didn't seem likely. It was far more likely that he had been elected Pope and had to fly off to the Vatican. I drove home quickly and checked my answering machine. There was one automated message urging me to buy a new set of tires before it was too late, which seemed ominous enough, but no message from Debs. I made coffee and waited for the thump of the morning paper against my door. There was a sense of unreality to the morning that was not entirely caused by the after effects of the champagne. Engaged, was I? Well, well. I wished that I could scold myself and demand to know what I thought I had been doing. But the truth was that, unfortunately, I hadn't been doing anything wrong. I was entirely clothed in virtue and diligence, and I had done nothing that could be called spectacularly stupid. Far from it. I had been proceeding with life in a noble and even exemplary manner, minding my own business and trying to help my sister recover her boyfriend, exercising, eating plenty of green vegetables, and not even slicing up other monsters. And somehow, all this pure and decent behavior had snuck around behind me and bitten me on the ass. Never a good deed goes unpunished, as Harry used to say. And what could I do about it now? Surely Rita would come to her senses. I mean, really, me? Who could possibly want to marry me? There had to be better alternatives, like becoming a nun or joining the Peace Corps. This was Dexter we were talking about. In a city the size of Miami, couldn't she find somebody who was at least human? And what was her rush to get married again anyway? It hadn't worked out terribly well for her the first time, but she was apparently willing to plunge right back into it again. Were women really this desperate to get married? Of course, there were the children to think about. Conventional wisdom would say they needed a father, and there was something to that, because where would I have been without Harry? And Aster and Cody had looked so happy. Even if I made Rita see that a comical mistake had happened, would the kids ever understand? I was on my second cup of coffee when the paper came. I glanced through the main sections, relieved to find that terrible things were still happening almost everywhere. At least the rest of the world hadn't gone crazy. By 7 o'clock, I thought it would be safe to call Deborah on her cell phone. There was no answer. I left a message, and 15 minutes later, she called back. "Good morning, sis," I said, and I marveled at the way I managed to sound cheerful. "Did you get some sleep?" "A little," she grumbled. "I woke up around 4 yesterday. I traced the package to a place in Hialeah. I drove around the area most of the night looking for the white van." If he dropped the package way up in Hialeah, he probably drove in from Key West to do it, I said. "I know that, goddammit," she snapped. "But what the hell else am I supposed to do?" "I don't know," I admitted. "But doesn't the guy from Washington get here today?" "We don't know anything about him," she said. "Just because Kyle is good doesn't mean this guy will be." She apparently didn't remember that Kyle hadn't shown himself to be particularly good, at least in public. He'd done nothing at all, in fact, except get himself captured and have his finger nipped off. But it didn't seem politic for me to comment on how good he was, so I simply said, "Well, we have to assume the new guy knows something about this that we don't know." Deborah snorted. "That wouldn't be too hard," she said. "I'll call you when he gets in." She hung up, and I got ready for work. Chapter 17. At 12:30, Deb stalked into my modest retreat off the forensic lab and threw a cassette tape on my desk. I looked up at her. She didn't seem happy, but that really wasn't much of a novelty. "From my answering machine at home," she said. "Listen to it." I lifted the hatch on my boombox and put in the tape Deb had flung at me. I pushed play. The tape beeped loudly, and then an unfamiliar voice said, "Sergeant, Morgan?" "Right. This is Dan Burdett from, Kyle Chutsky said I should call you. I'm on the ground at the airport, and I'll call you about getting together when I get to my hotel, which is..." There was a rustling sound, and he obviously moved the cell phone away from his mouth, since his voice got fainter. "What? Oh, hey, that's nice. All right, thanks." His voice got louder again. "I just met your driver. Thanks for sending somebody." "All right, I'll call you from the hotel." Deborah reached across my desk and switched off the machine. "I didn't send anybody to the fucking airport," she said. "And Captain Matthews damn sure didn't either. Did you send somebody to the fucking airport, Dexter?"
"My limo was out of gas," I said.
"Well then, goddammit," she said.
And I had to agree with her analysis. "Anyway," I said, "at least we found out how good Kyle's replacement is." Deborah slumped into the folding chair by my desk.
"Square fucking one," she said. "And Kyle is..."
She bit her lip and didn't finish the sentence. "Did you tell Captain Matthews about this yet?" I asked her. She shook her head.
"Well, he has to call them. They'll send somebody else." "Sure, great. They send somebody else who might make it all the way to the baggage claim this time. Shit, Dexter."
"We have to tell them, Debs," I said. "By the way, who are them? Did Kyle ever tell you exactly who he works for?" She sighed.
"No. He joked about working for the OGA, but he never said why that was funny."
"Well, whoever they are, they need to know," I said. I pried the cassette out of my boombox and put it on the desk in front of her. "There has to be something they can do." Deborah didn't move for a moment.
"Why do I get the feeling they've already done it, and Burdett was it?"
she said. Then she scooped up the tape and trudged out of my office. I was sipping coffee and digesting my lunch with the help of a jumbo chocolate chip cookie when the call came to report the scene of a homicide in the Miami Shores area. Angel No Relation and I drove over to where a body had been found in the shell of a small house on a canal that was being ripped apart and rebuilt. Construction had been temporarily halted while the owner and the contractor sued each other. Two teenaged boys skipping school had snuck into the house and found the body. It was laid out on heavy plastic on top of a sheet of plywood, which had been placed over two sawhorses. Someone had taken a power saw and neatly lopped off the head, legs, and arms. The whole thing had been left like that, with the trunk in the middle and the pieces simply trimmed off and moved a few inches away. And although the dark passenger had chuckled and whispered little dark nothings in my ear, I put it down to pure envy and went on with my work. There was certainly plenty of blood spatter for me to work with, still very fresh, and I probably would have spent a cheerful, efficient day finding and analyzing it if I hadn't happened to overhear the uniformed officer, who had been first on the scene, talking with a detective. "The wallet was right there by the body," Officer Snyder was saying. "Got a Virginia driver's license in the name of Daniel Chester Burdett." "Oh, well then," I said to the happy, chattering voice in the back seat of my brain. "That would certainly explain a lot, wouldn't it?" I looked again at the body. Although the removal of the head and the limbs had been fast and savage, there was a neatness to the arrangement that I could now recognize as slightly familiar, and the dark passenger chuckled happily in agreement. Between the trunk and each part, the gap was as precise as if it had been measured, and the whole presentation was arranged almost like an anatomy lesson. The hip bone disconnected from the leg bone. "Got the two boys who found it in the squad car," Snyder said to the detective. I glanced back at the two of them, wondering how to tell them my news. Of course, it was possible that I was wrong, but... "Son of a bitch," I heard someone mutter. I looked back to where Angel No Relation was squatting on the far side of the body. Once again, he was using his tweezers to hold up a small piece of paper. I stepped behind him and looked over his shoulder. In a clear and spidery hand, someone had written "Pogue" and crossed it out with a single line. "What's a pogue?" Angel asked. "His name?" "It's somebody who sits behind a desk and orders around the real troops," I told him. He looked at me. "How you know all this shit?" he asked. "I see a lot of movies," I said. Angel glanced back down at the paper. "I think the handwriting is the same," he said. "Like the other one," I said. "The one that never happened," he said. "I know. I was there." I straightened up and took a breath, thinking how nice it was to be right. "This one never happened either," I said, and walked over to where Officer Snyder was chatting with the detective. The detective in question was a pear-shaped man named Coulter. He was sipping from a large plastic bottle of Mountain Dew and looking out at the canal that ran by the backyard. "What do you think a place like this goes for?" he asked Snyder. "On a canal like that? Less than a mile from the bay, huh? Figure maybe what? Half a million? More?" "Excuse me, detective," I said. "I think we have a situation here." I'd always wanted to say that, but it didn't seem to impress Coulter.
"A situation? You been watching CSI or something?"
"Burdett is a federal agent," I said. "You have to call Captain Matthews right away and tell him."
"I have to," Coulter said.
"This is connected to something we're not supposed to touch," I said. "They came down from Washington and told the captain to back off." Coulter took a swig from his bottle.
"And did the captain back off?"
"Like a rabbit in reverse," I said.
Coulter turned and looked at Burdett's body.
A fed, he said.
He took one more swig as he stared at the severed head and limbs. Then he shook his head.
Those guys always come apart under pressure.
He looked back out the window and pulled out his cell phone. Deborah got to the scene just as Angel No Relation was putting his kit back in the van, which was 3 minutes before Captain Matthews. I don't mean to seem critical of the captain. To be perfectly fair, Debs didn't have to put on a fresh spray of Aramis, and he did. And redoing the knot in his tie must have taken some time, too. Just moments behind Matthews came a car I'd come to know as well as my own, a maroon Ford Taurus, piloted by Sergeant Doakes. "Hail, hail, the gang's all here," I said cheerfully. Officer Snyder looked at me like I had suggested we dance naked, but Coulter just pushed his index finger into the mouth of his soda bottle and let it dangle as he walked away to meet the captain. Deborah had been looking the scene over from the outside and directing Snyder's partner to move the perimeter tape back a little. By the time she finally walked over to talk to me, I had reached a startling conclusion. It had started as an exercise in ironic whimsy, but it grew into something that I couldn't argue with, as much as I tried. I stepped over to Coulter's expensive window and stared out, leaning on the wall and looking hard at the idea. For some reason, the dark passenger found the notion hugely amusing and began whispering frightful counterpoint. And finally, feeling like I was selling nuclear secrets to the Taliban, I realized it was all we could do. "Deborah," I said as she stalked over to where I stood by the window. "The cavalry isn't coming this time."
"No shit, Sherlock," she said.
"We are all there is, and we are not enough." She pushed a lock of hair away from her face and blew out a deep breath.
"What have I been saying?"
"But you didn't take the next step, sis. Since we are not enough, we need help. Somebody who knows something about this."
"For Christ's sake, Dexter! We've been feeding people like that to this guy."
"Which means the only remaining candidate at the moment is Sergeant Doakes," I said. It might not be fair to say that her jaw dropped, but she did stare at me with her mouth open before turning to look at Doakes, where he stood beside Burdett's body, talking to Captain Matthews.
"Sergeant Doakes," I repeated, "formerly Sergeant Doakes, of the Special Forces, on detached service in El Salvador."
She looked back at me, and then at Doakes again. "Deborah," I said, "if we want to find Kyle, we need to know more about this. We need to know the names on Kyle's list, and we need to know what kind of team it was and why all this is happening. And Doakes is the only one I can think of who knows any of it."
"Doakes wants you dead," she said.
"No working situation is ever ideal," I said, with my best smile of cheerful perseverance. "And I think he wants this to go away as badly as Kyle does."
"Probably not as much as Kyle," Deborah said. "Not as much as I do, either."
"Well then," I said, "this looks like your best shot." Deborah still didn't look convinced for some reason.
"Captain Matthews won't want to lose Doakes for this. We'd have to clear it with him."
I pointed to where that very same captain was conferring with Doakes.
"Behold," I said.
Deborah chewed her lip for a moment before she finally said,
"Shit, it might work."
"I can't think of anything else that might," I said. She took another breath, and then, as if someone had clicked a switch, she stepped toward Matthews and Doakes with her jaw clenched. I trailed along behind, trying hard to blend in with the bare walls so Doakes wouldn't pounce and rip out my heart.
"Captain," Deborah said, "we need to get proactive with this."
Even though proactive was one of his favorite words, Matthew stared at her like she was a cockroach in the salad.
What we need, he said, is for these people in Washington to send somebody competent to clean up this situation.
Deborah pointed at Burdette. They sent him, she said.
Matthews glanced down at Burdette and pushed his lips out thoughtfully. What do you suggest?
We have a couple of leads, she said, nodding toward me.
I really wished she hadn't, since Matthews swung his head in my direction and, much worse, so did Doakes. If his hungry dog expression was any indication, he apparently hadn't mellowed in his feelings toward me. What is your involvement with this? Matthews asked me.
He's providing forensic assistance, Deborah said, and I nodded modestly.
Shit, Doakes said.
There's a time factor here, Deborah said. We need to find this guy before more of these turn up. We can't keep a lid on it forever.
I think the term media feeding frenzy might be appropriate, I offered.
Always helpful.
Matthews glared at me.
I know the overall shape of what Chutsky was trying to do, Deborah went on. But I can't go on with it because I don't know any background details.
She stuck her chin out in the direction of Doakes.
Sergeant Doakes does.
Doakes looked surprised, which was obviously an expression he hadn't practiced enough. But before he could speak, Deborah plowed ahead.
I think the three of us together can catch this guy before another Fed gets on the ground and catches up to what's happened so far.
Shit, Doakes said again. You want me to work with him? He didn't need to point to let everyone know he meant me, but he did, anyway, pushing a muscular, knobby index finger at my face.
Yeah, I do, Deborah said.
Captain Matthews was chewing on his lip and looking undecided, and Doakes said, shit, again. I did hope that his conversational skills would improve if we were going to work together. You said you know something about this, Matthews said to Doakes, and the sergeant reluctantly turned his glare away from me and on to the captain. Uh-huh, said Doakes. From from the army, Matthews said. He didn't seem terribly frightened by Doakes's expression of petulant rage, but perhaps that was just the habit of command. Uh-huh, Doakes said again. Captain Matthews frowned, looking as much as he possibly could like a man of action making an important decision. The rest of us managed to control our goosebumps. Morgan, Captain Matthews finally said. He looked at Debs and then he paused. A van that said Action News on the side pulled up in front of the little house and people began to get out. God damn it, Matthews said. He glanced at the body and then at Doakes. Can you do it, Sergeant? They're not going to like it in Washington, Doakes said, and I don't much like it here. I'm beginning to lose interest in what they like in Washington, Matthews said. We have our own problems. Can you handle this? Doakes looked at me. I tried to look serious and dedicated, but he just shook his head. Yeah, he said, I can do this. Matthews clapped him on the shoulder. Good man, he said, and he hurried away to talk to the news crew. Doakes was still looking at me. I looked back.
Think how much easier it's going to be to keep track of me, I said.
When this is over, he said, just you and me.
But not until it's over, I said. And he finally nodded. Just once.
Until then, he said.
Chapter 18.
Doakes took us to a coffee shop on Calle Ocho, just across the street from a car dealership. He led us to a small table in the back corner and sat down, facing the door. We can talk here, he said, and he made it sound so much like a spy movie that I wished I had brought sunglasses. Still,
Perhaps Chutsky's would come in the mail, hopefully without his nose attached. Before we could actually talk, a man came from the back room and shook Dokes's hand.
Alberto, he said, ¿cómo estás?
And Dokes answered him in very good Spanish. Better than mine, to be honest, although I do like to think that my accent is better.
Luis, he said, más o menos.
They chattered away for a minute, and then Luis brought us all tiny cups of horribly sweet Cuban coffee and a plate of pastelitos. He nodded once at Dokes and then disappeared into the back room. Deborah watched the whole performance with growing impatience, and when Luis finally left us, she opened up.
We need the names of everybody from El Salvador, she blurted out.
Dokes just looked at her and sipped his coffee.
Be a big list, he said.
Deborah frowned.
You know what I mean, she said. God damn it, Dokes, he's got Kyle.
Dokes showed his teeth.
Yeah, Kyle getting old. Never would have got him in his prime.
What exactly were you doing down there? I asked him. I know it was a bit off message, but my curiosity about how he would answer got the best of me. Still smiling, if that's what it was, Dokes looked at me and said,
What do you think?
And just underneath the threshold of hearing, there came a quiet rumble of savage glee, answered right away from deep inside my dark back seat, one predator calling across a moonlit night to another. And really and truly, what else could he have been doing? Just as Dokes knew me, I knew Dokes for what he was. A cold killer. Even without what Chutsky had said, it was very clear what Dokes would have been doing in a homicidal carnival like El Salvador. He would have been one of the ringmasters.
Cut the staring contest, Deborah said. I need some names.
Dokes picked up one of the pastelitos and leaned back. Why don't you all bring me up to date? He said. He took a bite, and Deborah tapped a finger on the table before deciding that made sense.
All right, she said. We got a rough description of the guy who's doing this, and his van. A white van.
Dokes shook his head.
Don't matter. We know who's doing this.
We also got an ID on the first victim, I said. A man named Manuel Borges.
Well, well, Dokes said. Old Manny, huh? Really should have let me shoot him.
A friend of yours? I asked, but Dokes ignored me.
What else you got? He said.
Kyle had a list of names, Deborah said. Other men from the same unit. He said one of them would be the next victim, but he didn't tell me the names.
No, he wouldn't, Dokes said.
So we need you to tell us, she said.
Dokes appeared to think this over.
If I was a hot shot like Kyle, I'd pick one of these guys and stake him out.
Deborah pursed her lips and nodded.
Problem is, I am not a hot shot like Kyle. Just a simple cop from the country.
Would you like a banjo?
I asked, but for some reason he didn't laugh.
I only know about one guy from the old team here in Miami, he said,
after a quick and savage glance at me.
Oscar Acosta. Saw him at Publix 2 years ago. We could run him down.
He pointed his chin at Deborah.
Two other names I can think of. You look them up, see if they're here.
He spread his hands.
About all I got. I can maybe call some old buddies in Virginia, but no telling what that might stir up.
He snorted.
Anyway, take them 2 days to decide what I was really asking and what they ought to do about it.
So what do we do? Deborah said. We stake this guy out, the one you saw, or do we talk to him?
Dokes shook his head.
He remembered me. I can talk to him. You try to watch him, he'll know it and probably disappear.
He looked at his watch.
3:15. Oscar be home in a couple of hours. You all wait for my call. And then he gave me his 150-watt I'm-watching-you smile and said, "Why don't you go wait with your pretty fiancée?" And he got up and walked out, leaving us with the check. Deborah stared at me.
"Fiancée?" she said.
"It's not really definite," I said.
"You're engaged?"
"I was going to tell you," I said.
"When? On your third anniversary?"
"When I know how it happened," I said. "I still don't really believe it." She snorted.
"I don't either."
She stood up. "Come on, I'll take you back to work. Then you can go wait with your fiancé," she said. I left some money on the table and followed meekly. Vince Masuoka was passing by in the hall when Deborah and I got off the elevator.
"Shalom, boy chick," he said. "How's by you?"
"He's engaged," Deborah said before I could speak.
Vince looked at her like she had said I was pregnant.
"He's what?"
he said.
"Engaged. About to be married," she said.
"Married? Dexter?"
His face seemed to struggle with finding the right expression, which was not an easy task since he always seemed to be faking it. One of the reasons I got along with him. Two artificial humans, like plastic peas in a real pod. He finally settled on what looked like delighted surprise. Not very convincing, but still a sound choice.
"Mazel tov," he said, and gave me an awkward hug.
"Thank you," I said, still feeling completely baffled by the whole thing and wondering if I would actually have to go through with it.
"Well then," he said, rubbing his hands together, "we can't let this go unpunished. Tomorrow night at my house?"
"For what?" I asked. He gave me his very best phony smile.
"Ancient Japanese ritual, dating back to the Tokugawa shogunate. We get smashed and watch dirty movies," he said, and then he turned to leer at Deborah. "We can get your sister to jump out of a cake."
"How about if you jump up your ass instead?" Deb said.
"That's very nice, Vince, but I don't think," I said, trying to avoid anything that made my engagement more official, and also trying to stop the two of them from trading their clever put-downs before I got a headache. But Vince wouldn't let me finish.
"No, no," he said. "This is highly necessary. A matter of honor. No escape. Tomorrow night, 8 o'clock, he said.
And looking at Deborah as he walked away, he added, "And you only have 24 hours to practice twirling your tassels." "Go twirl your own tassel," she said.
"Ha ha!"
he said, with his terrible fake laugh, and he disappeared down the hall.
"Little freak,"
Deborah muttered, and she turned to go in the other direction.
"Stick with your fiancé after work. I'll call you when I hear from Dokes."
There wasn't a great deal left of the workday. I filed a few things, ordered a case of Luminol from our supplier, and acknowledged receiving half a dozen memos that had piled up in my email inbox. And with a feeling of real accomplishment, I headed down to my car and drove through the soothing carnage of rush hour. I stopped at my apartment for a change of clothes. Deb's was nowhere to be seen, but the bed was unmade, so I knew she had been here. I stuffed my things into a carry-on bag and headed for Rita's. It was fully dark by the time I got to Rita's house. I didn't really want to go there, but wasn't quite sure what else to do. Deborah expected me to be there if she needed to find me, and she was using my apartment. So I parked in Rita's driveway and got out of my car. Purely from reflex, I glanced across the street to Sergeant Dokes's parking spot. It was empty, of course. He was occupied talking with Oscar, his old army buddy. And the sudden realization grew on me that I was free, away from the unfriendly bloodhound eyes that had for so long now kept me from being me. A slow, swelling hymn of pure, dark joy rose up inside me, and the counterpoint thumped down from a sudden moon oozing out from a low cloud bank. A lurid, guttering three-quarter moon, still low and huge in the dark sky.
and the music blared from the loudspeakers and climbed into the upper decks of Dexter's dark arena, where the sly whispers grew into a roaring cheer to match the moon music, a rousing chant of "Do it, do it, do it," and my body quivered from the inside out as I came up on point and thought, why not? Why not indeed? I could slip away for a few happy hours, taking my cell phone with me, of course. I wouldn't want to be irresponsible about it. But why not take advantage of the doaxless moony night and slide away into the dark breeze? The thought of those red boots pulled at me like a spring tide. Riker lived just a few miles from here. I could be there in 10 minutes. I could slip in and find the proof I needed, and then, I suppose I would have to improvise. But the voice just under the edge of sound was full of ideas tonight, and we could certainly come up with something to lead to the sweet release we both needed so much. Oh, do it, Dexter, the voices howled, and as I paused on tiptoe to listen and think again, why not, and came up with no reasonable answer, the front door of Rita's house swung wide, and Aster peered out. It's him, she called back into the house. He's here. And so I was, here, instead of there. Reeling into the couch instead of dancing away into darkness. Wearing the weary mask of Dexter the sofa spud instead of the bright silver gleam of the Dark Avenger. Come on in, you, Rita said, filling the doorway with such warm good cheer that I felt my teeth grind together. And the crowd inside howled with disappointment, but slowly filed out of the stadium. Game over. Because after all, what could we do? Nothing, of course, which is what we did, trailing meekly into the house behind the happy parade of Rita, Aster, and ever-quiet Cody. I managed not to whimper, but really, wasn't this pushing the envelope a tiny bit? Weren't we all taking advantage of Dexter's cheerful good nature just a trifle too much? Dinner was annoyingly pleasant, as if to prove to me that I was buying into a lifetime of happiness and pork chops, and I played along even though my heart was not in it. I cut the meat into small chunks, wishing I was cutting something else, and thinking of the South Pacific cannibals who referred to humans as long pork. It was appropriate, really, because it was that other pork I truly longed to slice into, and not this tepid mushroom soup-covered thing on my plate. But I smiled and stabbed the green beans and made it all the way through to coffee somehow. Ordeal by pork chop. But I survived. After dinner, Rita and I sipped our coffee as the kids ate small portions of frozen yogurt. Although coffee is supposed to be a stimulant, it gave me no help in thinking of a way out of this. Not even a way to slip out for a few hours, let alone avoid this lifelong bliss that had snuck up behind me and grabbed me around the neck. I felt like I was slowly fading away at the edges and melting into my disguise, until eventually the happy rubber mask would meld with my actual features, and I would truly become the thing I had been pretending to be. Taking the kids to soccer, buying flowers when I drank too many beers, comparing detergents and cutting costs, instead of flensing the wicked of their unneeded flesh. It was a very depressing line of thought, and I might have grown unhappy if the doorbell hadn't rung just in time. That must be Deborah, I said. I'm fairly sure I kept most of the hope for rescue out of my voice. I got up and went to the front door, swinging it open to reveal a pleasant-looking, overweight woman with long blonde hair.
Oh, she said. You must be, is Rita here?
Well, I suppose I was, Although until now I hadn't been aware of it. I called Rita to the door, and she came, smiling.
Kathy, she said. So nice to see you. How are the boys?
Kathy lives next door, she explained to me. Aha, I said. I knew most of the kids in the area, but not their parents. But this one was apparently the mother of the faintly sleazy 11-year-old boy next door, and his nearly always absent older brother. Since that meant she was probably not carrying a car bomb or a vial of anthrax, I smiled and went back to the table with Cody and Aster.
Jason's at band camp, she said. Nick is lounging around the house trying to reach puberty so he can grow a mustache.
Oh, Lord, Rita said.
Nicky is a creep, Aster whispered. He wanted me to pull down my pants so he could see.
Cody stirred his frozen yogurt into a frozen pudding.
Listen, Rita, I'm sorry to bother you at dinner time, Kathy said.
We just finished. Would you like some coffee?
Oh, no, I'm down to one cup a day, she said. Doctor's orders. But it's about our dog. I just wanted to ask if you'd seen Rascal. He's been missing for a couple of days now, and Nick is so worried.
I haven't seen him. Let me ask the kids, Rita said. But as she turned to ask, Cody looked at me, got up without a sound, and walked out of the room. Aster stood up, too.
We haven't seen him, she said. Not since he knocked over the trash last week.
And she followed Cody out of the room. They left their desserts on the table, still only half eaten. Rita watched them go with her mouth open, and then turned back to her neighbor.
I'm sorry, Kathy. I guess nobody's seen him. But we'll keep an eye open, all right? I'm sure he'll turn up. Tell Nick not to worry.
She prattled on for another minute with Kathy, while I looked at the frozen yogurt and wondered what I'd just seen. The front door closed, and Rita came back to her cooling coffee.
Kathy's a nice person, she said, but her boys can be a handful. She's divorced. Her ex bought a place in Isla Morada. He's a lawyer. But he stays down there, so Kathy's had to raise the boys alone, and I don't think she's very firm sometimes. She's a nurse with a podiatrist over by the university.
And her shoe size? I asked.
Am I blathering?
Rita asked. She bit her lip.
I'm sorry. I guess I was just worrying a little bit. I'm sure it's just...
She shook her head and looked at me.
Dexter, did you...
I never got to find out if I did, because my cell phone chirped. Excuse me, I said, and I went over to a table by the front door where I had left it.
Doak's just called,
Deborah said to me without even saying hello.
The guy he went to talk to is running. Doak's is following to see where he goes, but he needs us for backup.
Quickly, Watson, the game's afoot, I said. But Deborah was not in a literary mood.
I'll pick you up in 5 minutes, she said.
Chapter 19. I left Rita with a hurried explanation and went outside to wait. Deborah was as good as her word, and in 5.5 minutes we were heading north on Dixie Highway.
They're out on Miami Beach, she told me. Doak said he approached the guy, Oscar, and told him what's up. Oscar says, let me think about it. Doak says, okay, I'll call you. But he watches the house from up the street, and 10 minutes later the guy is out the door and into his car with an overnight bag.
Why would he run now? Wouldn't you run if you knew Danko was after you? No, I said, thinking happily of what I might actually do if I came face to face with the doctor. I would set some kind of trap for him and let him come. And then, I thought, but didn't say aloud to Deborah.
Well, Oscar isn't you, she said.
So few of us are, I said.
Where's he headed?
She frowned and shook her head.
Right now he's just cruising around, and Doak's is tailing him.
Where do you think he's going to lead us? I asked.
Deborah shook her head and cut around an old ragtop Cadillac loaded with yelling teenagers. It doesn't matter, she said, and headed up the on-ramp onto the Palmetto Expressway, with the pedal to the floor. Oscar is still our best chance. If he tries to leave the area, we'll pick him up.
But until then, we need to stick with him to see what happens.
Very good. A really terrific idea. But what exactly do we think might happen?
I don't know, Dexter, she snapped at me. But we know the guy's a target sooner or later, all right? And now he knows it, too. So maybe he's just trying to see if he's being followed before he runs.
Shit,
she said, and swerved around an old flatbed truck loaded with crates of chickens. The truck was going possibly 35 miles per hour, had no taillights, and three men sat on top of the load, hanging on to battered hats with one hand and the load with the other. Deborah gave them a quick blast of the siren as she pulled around them. It didn't seem to have any effect. The men on top of the load didn't even blink. Anyway, she said as she straightened out the wheel and accelerated again. Doakes wants us on the Miami side for backup, so Oscar can't get too fancy. We'll run parallel along Biscayne.
It made sense. As long as Oscar was on Miami Beach, he couldn't escape in any other direction. If he tried to dash across a causeway or head north to the far side of Holliver Park and cross, we were there to pick him up. Unless he had a helicopter stashed, we had him cornered. I let Deborah drive, and she headed north rapidly without actually killing anyone. At the airport, we swung east on the 836. The traffic picked up a little here, and Deborah wove in and out, concentrating fiercely. I kept my thoughts to myself, and she displayed her years of training with Miami traffic by winning what amounted to a non-stop free-for-all high-speed game of chicken. We made it safely through the interchange with I-95 and slid down onto Biscayne Boulevard. I took a deep breath and let it out carefully as Deborah eased back into street traffic and down to normal speed. The radio crackled once, and Doakes' voice came over the speaker.
Morgan, what's your 20?
Deborah lifted the microphone and told him. Biscayne at the MacArthur Causeway. There was a short pause, and then Doakes said,
He's pulled over by the drawbridge at the Venetian Causeway. Cover it on your side.
10-4, Deborah said, and I couldn't help saying, I feel so official when you say that. What does that mean? She said.
Nothing, really, I said.
She glanced at me, a serious cop look, but her face was still young, and for just a moment it felt like we were kids again, sitting in Harry's patrol car and playing cops and robbers. Except that this time, I got to be a good guy. A very unsettling feeling.
This isn't a game, Dexter,
she said, because of course she shared that same memory.
Kyle's life is at stake here.
And her features dropped back into her serious, large fish face as she went on.
I know it probably doesn't make sense to you, but I care about that man. He makes me feel so... Shit. You're getting married and you still won't ever get it.
We had come to the traffic light at Northeast 15th Street, and she turned right. What was left of the Omni Mall loomed up on the left, and ahead of us was the Venetian Causeway. I'm not very good at feeling things, Debs, I said, and I really don't know at all about this marriage thing. But I don't much like it when you're unhappy. Deborah pulled off opposite the little marina by the old Herald building and parked the car facing back toward the Venetian Causeway. She was quiet for a moment, and then she hissed out her breath and said,
I'm sorry.
That caught me a bit off guard, since I admit that I had been preparing to say something very similar, just to keep the social wheels greased. Almost certainly I would have phrased it in a slightly more clever way, but the same essence.
For what? I don't mean to... I know you're different, Dex. I'm really trying to get used to that, and... But you're still my brother.
Adopted, I said.
That's horseshit, and you know it. You're my brother, and I know you're only here because of me.
Actually, I was hoping I'd get to say 10-4 on the radio later. She snorted.
All right, be an asshole, but thanks anyway.
You're welcome.
She picked up the radio. Doakes, what's he doing?
After a brief pause, Doakes replied,
Looks like he's talking on his cell phone.
Deborah frowned and looked at me. If he's running, who's he going to talk to on the phone?
I shrugged. He might be arranging a way out of the country, or...
I stopped.
The idea was far too stupid to think about, and that should have kept it out of my head automatically. But somehow, there it was, bouncing off the gray matter and waving a small red flag.
What? Deborah demanded.
I shook my head. Not possible. Stupid. Just a wild thought that won't go away.
All right. How wild?
What if... Now, I did say this was stupid.
It's a lot stupider to dick around like this, she snapped. What's the idea?
What if Oscar is calling the good doctor and trying to bargain his way out? I said. And I was right. It did sound stupid. Deb snorted.
Bargain with what?
Well, I said, Doak said he's carrying a bag, so he could have money, bearer bonds, a stamp collection. I don't know. But he probably has something that might be even more valuable to our surgical friend.
Like what?
He probably knows where everybody else from the old team is hiding.
Shit, she said. Give up everybody else in exchange for his life?
She chewed on her lip as she thought that over. After a minute, she shook her head. That's pretty far-fetched, she said. Far-fetched is a big step up from stupid, I said.
Oscar would have to know how to get in touch with the doctor.
One spook can always find a way to get to another. There are lists and databases and mutual contacts. You know that. Didn't you see Bourne Identity?
Yeah, but how do we know Oscar saw it? She said.
I'm just saying it's possible.
Uh-huh,
she said. She looked out the window, thinking, then made a face and shook her head.
Kyle said something. That after a while you'd forget what team you were on. Like baseball with free agency. So you'd get friendly with guys on the other side and...
Shit, that's stupid. So whatever side Danko is on, Oscar could find a way to reach him.
So fucking what? We can't, she said.
We were both quiet for a few minutes after that. I suppose Debs was thinking about Kyle and wondering if we would find him in time. I tried to imagine caring about Rita the same way and came up blank. As Deborah had so astutely pointed out, I was engaged and still didn't get it. And I never would either, which I usually regard as a blessing. I have always felt that it was preferable to think with my brain rather than with certain other wrinkled parts located slightly south. I mean, seriously, don't people ever see themselves staggering around, drooling and mooning, all weepy-eyed and weak-kneed and rendered completely idiotic over something even animals have enough sense to finish quickly so they can get on with more sensible pursuits, like finding fresh meat? Well, as we all agreed, I didn't get it. So I just looked out across the water to the subdued lights of the homes on the far side of the causeway. There were a few apartment buildings close to the toll booth, and then a scattering of houses almost as big. Maybe if I won the lottery, I could get a real estate agent to show me something with a small cellar, just big enough for one homicidal photographer to fit in snugly under the floor. And as I thought it, a soft whisper came from my personal backseat voice. But of course, there was nothing I could do about that, except perhaps applaud the moon that hung over the water. And across that same moon-painted water floated the sound of a clanging bell, signaling that the drawbridge was about to go up. The radio crackled.
He's moving, Doak said. Gonna run the drawbridge. Watch for him. White Toyota 4Runner.
I see him, Deborah said into the radio. We're on him.
The white SUV came across the causeway and onto 15th Street just moments before the bridge went up. After a slight pause to let him get ahead, Deborah pulled out and followed. At Biscayne Boulevard, he turned right, and a moment later, we did too.
He's heading north on Biscayne, she said into the radio.
Copy that, Doak said. I'll follow out here.
The Forerunner moved at normal speed through moderate traffic, keeping to a mere 5 miles per hour above the speed limit, which in Miami is considered tourist speed, slow enough to justify a blast of the horn from the drivers who passed him. But Oscar didn't seem to mind. He obeyed all the traffic signals and stayed in the right lane, cruising along as if he had no particular place to go, and was merely out for a relaxing after-dinner drive.
As we came up on the 79th Street Causeway, Deborah picked up the radio.
"We're passing 79th Street," she said. "He's in no hurry, proceeding north."
10-4, Doak said, and Deborah glanced at me.
"I didn't say anything," I said.
"You thought the hell out of it," she said.
We moved on north, stopping twice at traffic signals. Deborah was careful to stay several cars behind. No mean feat in Miami traffic, with most of the cars trying to go around, over, or through all the others. A fire engine went wailing past in the other direction, blasting its horn at the intersections. For all the effect it had on the other drivers, it might have been a lamb bleeding. They ignored the siren and clung to their hard-won places in the scrambled line of traffic. The man behind the wheel of the fire engine, being a Miami driver himself, simply wove in and out with the horn and siren playing. Duet for traffic. We reached 123rd Street, the last place to cross back to Miami Beach before 826 ran across at North Miami Beach, and Oscar kept heading north. Deborah told Doak by radio as we passed it.